Hello and welcome to another episode of In Her Corner. I'm your host, Lisely Satali. In Her Corner is a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport, on and off the field. And today I'm really excited to introduce today's guest, who's Mary Connor McVeigh, but she's somebody I really admire. Hello, Mary, how are you?
Hi, Lisely. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, Mary, if we could just start off by telling everybody a little bit about yourself and how you got into sport, and then I'd love us to talk about Soccer Without Borders because it's such an inspirational project.
Sure. So I grew up in the East Coast of the United States, but when I was about six, my family moved to Hamburg, Germany for 2 years. And at the time, I was a soccer player insofar as I mostly knew which direction to dribble the ball in my co-ed recreational team. But when you move to Germany and you're in that culture, it becomes a lifestyle. So soccer became just a part of my identity and my life. I was there when Germany, the men's team, won the World Cup in 1990. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, from there, it became a part of my everyday world. And so sport has been my best friend and my my a part of my life since then for over 30 years. I think nothing's been a part of my life longer than maybe my older brother and my parents. And so I've been fortunate to be a part of the game as a player, as a coach, as a fan. As a teammate, and I'm just really grateful to be here and be a part of this movement and this effort to really make sport more gender equitable and really highlight women who are trailblazing in all different ways. I have to say I'm intimidated by the lineup that I'm following here.
No. I'm going to start off by giving you a warning that lots of other guests haven't had yet, Mary. Don't know if you've listened. I introduce a $50 fine for any sort of imposter syndrome type comments, any self-deprecating, any non-recognition of the great work you're doing, because you are definitely more than worthy to be on here together with all the other women. So, yeah. So if you
is there like a nonprofit discount for the $50 fine or
$40, but okay. Exactly. So whilst we're on the subject, because I want to really dive in deep to understand how you obviously moved from playing, because you used to play the game, to now running this great organization, Soccer Without Borders, and the kind of work you do around the world. Before that, I just want to spend some time to talk about that early memory you spoke about there when you were in Germany. Would you say that experience of living in Germany, having moved there as an expat, and then obviously then getting to the fabric of the culture and seeing the German team win that World Cup, would you say that was your earliest sporting memory that kind of hooked you in and got you to really feel as excited, as enthralled as you are by the game?
Yeah, my earliest sporting memory is this little yellow foam soccer ball that my brother and I played with in our apartment where we were living in Germany. There was this kind of like landing area before you come into the apartment. It was probably 8 feet by 8 feet. And we would just go in there and it was like the arena. And I'm playing against my older brother. The neighbors were complaining to my parents day and night. And we would just play off the walls. And so my earliest memories, a lot of them involve my older brother, in part because moving to Germany, not speaking German, being a girl trying to play sport at that time, I had very few friends. So my brother and my soccer ball kind of became my lifeline and the way that I got to know people. I remember the first day getting dropped off at school and not speaking the language and coming into this German public school in the 80s, you know, this is pre-Berlin Wall falling. Yeah. And so many of the kids in the school hadn't met an American. Yeah. And so kind of just being dropped off there and trying to figure out how do I fit in here? How is anyone even going to know me? I can't tell them about who I am. I don't know where I am or what I'm doing. Yeah. So, you know, recess, soccer at recess is the thing that I looked forward to the most. And I would say those are my earliest sport memories.
Yeah. And I guess probably being able to play and be as passionate in your expression of your involvement in soccer was probably a really great bonding tool for you with a lot of the kids at the school, because you don't need a language, right, in common in order to be able to express that shared love for the game.
You can just play. If you want to play, if you can play, if you're there and willing, you know, if you can play, you can play. And that was how it was. Mostly boys at recess treated me. I think my brother helped to kind of talk me into that group. But it is how I made friends. I was also fortunate to have, you know, a dad that advocated for me when there were no girls' teams. He talked me onto a boys' team so that I could have that experience in that community. And I think, you know, as a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, you don't really process how powerful that is to have advocates for you, to have somebody who is clearing a path that is not on paper a path. Yeah. And they clear that for you. And you know, you just are a kid that wants to play and make friends. And I think in retrospect, valuing and recognizing the advocates that sort of cleared that path for me is something that I really channel into my work now.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's such a great point, right? Earlier I was speaking with Maggie Murphy, who's the general manager of Lewis FC, who I know you know well. So, and we were talking about that role that fathers and men in girls' lives play as almost a gatekeeper, right? And if they open that gate and they give the opportunities to you from a very young age, where it becomes normalized. So for you, your relationship with playing soccer was normalized. So it helped you, obviously, with your talent. I think let's not skim over the fact that you were actually a really good player. So I won't let that lie. But it helped to give you that initial confidence, right? That it just came natural to you that you would be getting to play. You know, it didn't have to be a barrier. So with that in mind, I want to talk a lot about the work that you do with Soccer Without Borders, because the work is very much rooted in the purpose of making the game more inclusive and going into parts of the world where, unfortunately, that gatekeepers don't see the value. It's not intuitive to them to open the door to let girls particularly play, but also the safety of children, because often you're in war conflict zones. So I would like to just spend some time, if you could sort of educate all of us. I know a little bit, but I also for those people listening, as to what you know, because you co-founded Soccer Without Borders and now you serve as the executive director, and you guys have got phenomenal accolades, which are so deserved for the really impactful work you've done in some places where other governments have shirked away from. And so, you know, I want you to spend some time to explain to people what that role has entailed and what your day-to-day looks like.
That's a big question, and I know you kind of started with this sporting journey and my history. And I think when I think about where we are now with Soccer Without Borders, and I think you described it well, Soccer Without Borders exists to try to build a more inclusive world using this sport that more than half of humanity tunes in and watches this sport in some way. You know, over 4 billion people play or involved in soccer. I can't think of a entity or thread on earth that ties people together more than this sport. And how do you get from sort of an 8-year-old, I love the sport, and through my history with it, I got to be good at this sport, to then 30 years later, kind of trying to continue to channel that into these opportunities. So I think there are sort of moments along that path that led to becoming co-founder and executive director, but I'm happy to skip to the end here and maybe we'll fill in the between. But Soccer Without Borders is a nonprofit organization. We're based in the United States, but we've done work in just about a dozen countries over the last 13 years. We have programming that serves, that aims to create social inclusion for marginalized groups. So two of the kind of social change issues or focus areas that we've felt we can contribute to the most are advancing gender equality through sport for all the reasons you just named, and also social inclusion for refugee and immigrant youth. So because of the populations we serve, we actually serve young people who come from over 75 different countries. So while we've worked in a number of countries directly, we have experienced within our programs just an incredible diversity and strength and diversity of cultures, and the number of people and families of all religions, all genders, all ethnicities that this sport touches and can reach. And so we are now, we've grown over the last 14 years to from an all volunteer kind of bootstrap in your free time with a job on a full-time job during the day to now 60 plus employees. We have seven different program offices. We have year-round programs, and just really trying to maximize our contribution in particular to those two kind of social change issues that we feel we have the most expertise to contribute.
No, definitely. And I think those are two particular social cause issues that are currently have a phenomenal spotlight on them, right? Because of recent world events. And I know, you know, when you and I initially started talking at the height of this, this was kind of a very pointed pressure for your organization. So how have you managed that current challenge where people are being pulled and pushed in different directions? How do you guys manage to sort of quell that and stay focused in and on keeping your mission going?
Our mission is on its face about soccer plus education plus community. And if you combine these with sort of the right intentionality and focus and continuity, you can sort of create a formula that changes outcomes for individuals, right? And that's, you measure that, you create an entity that can deliver this over and over. It's sort of the business meets nonprofit model that you can mechanize youth development or outcomes. But I actually think the secret sauce of Soccer Without Borders is not that. I think we do that pretty well. We have programs that are consistent and thoughtful and intentional, with led by well-trained coaches and practitioners. But it's about people. And it's about relationships. And that is why football, because I know you have an audience that's outside of the U.S., but this is why football, to me...
German roots here, I love it.
Football is the sport to do that. It is inherently interpersonal and interdependent. I don't care if you are Abby Wambach or Lionel Messi or Sam Mewis. You need other players around you. You need to utilize them well. And that means that at the heart of this sport, if you're truly using it to create a better world, a more inclusive world, you have to be all about relationships, and you have to be about meeting people where they are, understanding what they're going through, and shaping something better together. And so I think when you talk about this moment, we're talking about compounding challenges. So you have social inequality, economic inequality, racial inequities and systemic injustice and these things, and then COVID and you just sort of like you're like adding rocks to a backpack that was already full. And if you're not approaching those things from a place of people first and thinking about, you know, what people are going through and truly walking with them, walking together, I don't think the best program design in the world will achieve change without that. And so I think the reasons that Soccer Without Borders has been able to adapt, been able to be effective throughout this crisis, is that we were already people-centric. We were already focused that way. So as soon as, you know, every challenge that comes up, my phone, my text, my WhatsApp, what do we have? Like 17 different ways to communicate now. All those apps, you know, they blow up.
Right, it drives you crazy.
And it's like, what are we going to do now? You know, what are we doing? Let's adapt. Let's take action. What are we going to do? Yeah. And so I think that is maybe the thing I'm most proud of in Soccer Without Borders, is that you can create a community of people who believe that they can be the change they want to see in the world and will not just say it, but take action every day when things are most challenging, to step up and say, how can I help? How can I contribute?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's about that piece that you're saying about seeing people, right? Being very, very deliberate about your intention to say, this is, we acknowledge that you are going through a challenge and we're going to meet you there, right? We're going to walk with you through that challenge. And I think these often being, I think sometimes with certain programs, particularly when corporates get involved, and I'm talking here about the kind of businesses I work with, we see projects like yours and we get so excited and we clamor up and we're like, yes, we want to get involved, we want to do it. But I think this is probably a good moment for those businesses to also interrogate themselves and say, if you want people-centric first, it's going to be so hard for you to be able to then come in and sponsor or partner with a great project like yours, right? Because there's going to be a clash of culture to begin with, right? If that organization isn't. So how did you instill that culture? Because for me, I think that's a winning formula for any business in the world, whether they're not-for-profit or they are a corporate entity. So how do you instill that value in everybody to be very people-first focused?
Yeah, I love that pivot. I love that question. You know, I read this quote. I don't know who to attribute it to, but recently it said, "Trust change happens at the speed of trust." And I think that is where there can be a disconnect of culture, where you're saying, you know, how can I trust? How do I know what your intention is, and how can I trust that? And that's the case for partnerships like what you just described, a corporate entity with a nonprofit, but it's also a nonprofit with its beneficiaries, its communities. You need to build trust, even if you are perceiving, you know, I'm bringing this resource that you need or want, or you say you need or want, there needs to be a trust there. Otherwise, it reinforces a power dynamic that is harmful and counterproductive to what you're trying to achieve together. So I think the answer to your question is to figure out who are the relationships involved and what will it take to build that trust? How long will it take? There's some relationships that, I trusted you. We met once, but you knew other people who I trust and admire. And so, we're able to build that more quickly. I'm showing one of my journey's dots is a philosophy degree from Dartmouth College. So I'm starting to betray that a little bit, that I'm a philosopher at heart.
Do you want to tell a little bit more about that philosophy background? And because I guess it's probably also influenced a lot of your perception, right, of using football as a tool for social change. Because I think a lot of people who are involved in football are on the commercial money side, but because that's easy. I would say that's the easier side, personally, just from my observation. And I say that sitting working for a sports broadcast, I would say showing off the beautiful game, doing all the tapes and roll calls. Yes, of course, there's challenges, but we should never kid anybody. We're definitely, we picked the cushy part of the deal. Is that what was your motivation? Is that what was your way in, that you thought, actually thinking about this critically, this is actually much bigger than just the game?
I think it's much bigger than the entertainment, the business side of the game. And I think that is where kind of philosophy meets sociology. If you view football as a business, as a product, as a potential revenue, as entertainment, then, that I think narrows your view of what football and what sport has the potential to create. I view it as a cultural phenomenon. It is really hard to get people, particularly young people, to do anything, right? So it's like, how do I convince you to do something healthy, positive? That's top of mind right now as we're trying to navigate a pandemic and we're thinking about human behavior. What motivates human behavior for themselves and for people they care about, for the public? Mm-hmm. Football has somehow, as a phenomenon, it motivates people all around the world to play it, to engage with it, to live it, to love it, to admire it. And that to me is a very unique thing, that there would be something that pervasive in the world that touches that many people's lives. And I think what I love about Soccer Without Borders and sort of this side of the game, this niche of the game, is that I believe the game belongs to the people that play it. I've been involved with the game as a coach and as a administrator, but it's a player's game. I really believe if you've done your coaching well, then when the game kicks off, you know, the decisions belong to the players. There's not much you can do as a coach. And I think if you were to take that analogy and actually apply it to the game as a whole, you know, the game belongs to the people who
are in it,
and it should be that way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very limiting to view the game solely from a business perspective, because that's actually quite the minority of people that get to be involved in the game in that way.
Well, that's true.
As a broadcaster, as a professional player, as you know, in these clubs that get the most attention, mm-hmm. where actually everywhere I go, you will find a pickup soccer game. You will find somebody carrying a ball, somebody juggling a ball. You know, every beach, every empty lot.
Somebody in the furthest part of the world, you find them wearing a shirt that you never thought it would be there. And that's that instant connection, right, that you get immediately from that moment.
And that's the majority. Yeah. And the vast majority. That's the way people interact with this game. Yeah. And so I think there is probably the same power dynamic that within the game that says, how is it that this sort of minority that has the majority of resource gets the most attention and gets the most investment. And that's something I'm really excited about I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit, but you know, the women's game has such an opportunity right now.
I was actually just about to ask you about that. So let's talk about it now. When we're looking at these opportunities, you know, because I really love what you said there about not narrowing the view and not narrowing the participation realm, right? Because at the moment in time, the business of sport has done that. We've more than doubled down on the business side, on the men's side of the game. And I think COVID was a really good wake-up call for that, because a lot of businesses, leagues, sponsors, broadcasters, we all suddenly had to be like, whoa, hello. What's happened here? They're not playing. Our pockets are hurt and we don't have a diversification strategy, because for so long, too many of us buried our head in the sand about investing in the women's game, which is over 50% of the world's population, by the way. To me as a marketer, that's dumb. Because, oh, where's the audience? Where's my total addressable market, etc.? So what do you see as this moment in time as being a really good opportunity to grow the women's game? Because some of the stuff that's been happening across there with you guys in the States, with the National Women's Soccer League, you know, with the investment that came from Alex O'Hane Jr., Serena Williams making Alex Olympia the youngest ever football franchise owner in the world, I believe she is now. That is so exciting, and it's driven such phenomenal momentum, particularly around viewership. Do you see that as being the only kind of opportunity in getting these kind of big figures to get into the game and invest in it properly? Or do you see other ways in from the work you've been doing over the years?
I love that question. And I think you've talked to a lot of women. I hope I don't get a $50 fine for this. But when you talk to Maggie Murphy and Beck Smith, you know, there is a vision for shifting the business of football from a club level, you know, advocating for equality, equal pay for the men's and women, amazing, from a media level. And so I believe that change happens when the sort of top-down structures meet a bottom-up tidal wave. And I believe my role is in helping to create that groundswell of girls and women from communities everywhere that can sort of, we can meet in the middle somewhere. And so I'm going to focus on that. I really think there is an opportunity to create women's football, not in the image of men's football, which, mm-hmm. let's be honest, reflects the inequality of the world. Like that, it is an exact mirror image of the economic and social inequality that we see in the world. And then it's not, shouldn't be surprising to see racist attitudes playing out with it within the field that we revere so much, like right on the field. We've allowed it to be embedded. And that's because men's football is a mirror of the world that we say we want to change. So as women, let's build something better. Let's build women's football in the image of the change we want to see in the world. And that has to mean girls everywhere have the opportunity to access it. It has to start with that. And I don't believe access is a silver bullet that a girl who plays sports suddenly, you know, can reach her potential in every way off the field. I think there is intentionality and investment and gender norms and a whole surrounding piece of support that needs to go with that. But let's start with that. Let's start with the intention of women's football is not just going to be North America and Europe. It's not going to be the US, Canada, Mexico, and UEFA, and Australia, and New Zealand. It's going to be everybody. How do we bring everyone along and give them access to this from the beginning? Yeah. And that I worry that is, you know, if it's driven solely from a perspective of equal media investment or, you know, equal contracts at the top without the groundswell bottom happening too with equal attention.
Yeah.
I worry that we won't meet in the middle. We'll actually create something too similar
to the men's
game and its challenges. You know, we're not exempt from that as women of creating something unequal. But I think we have a real opportunity because we're early enough stages where you have the attention of those with resources in the game, but you also have social movements and interest. You know, these are real issues that the world is grappling with: climate change, inequality, COVID, racism, structural inequity. I think you have a chance to recognize and truly value the cultural phenomenon of football and build women's football to be the cultural change agent that it could be. And I personally think women are, that's the right group of women at the top who can lead that.
Yeah.
You see it embedded already from Megan Rapinoe to Moya Dodd. You see it there already.
I was going to say, you can definitely feel it. And I also think it's the mainstream focus now on those women, for me, has been one of the things that I've taken the most heart in, the way that they've finally given respect and airtime to talk about these challenges and those issues. And I think the point you were making there around the actual making sure that we're embedding the grassroots to come up as a groundswell is so important, because I think that often gets forgotten about. We just suddenly think the Megan Rapinoes of the world just appear one day. We wake up like, boom, we got 10 of them. Fantastic. But from your experience, obviously, because you came up through and you played at a professional level, what kind of things have you identified as sort of, if you were to distill it to one key thing, businesses or people who want to get involved in the game can do to better support that mid to up groundswell to get that, to accelerate, if you like, that change at the top?
One thing, it goes against every, naming one thing goes like, that's every fair. Ounce of my being as a philosopher is like, this is all interrelated. You can't just reduce it. But I think when I think about Megan Rapinoe, when I think about my own experience,
a couple of things, because obviously you've got your lived experience. So it could even be like a learning from the actual process you went through, because I think that's so valuable for people to get insight to as well. Right.
Yeah. There's a couple of things that come immediately to mind. You name Megan Rapinoe and you name my experience. We are a generation that benefited from Title IX, from Billie Jean King taking on the iconic sort of message of this has to be equal. It has to be equal in law. And there needs to be accountability to that law, which we're still working on. But it's when it's written, that's incredibly powerful to have something enshrined in the way that institutions are designed that says, if you have a boys team, you need to have a girls team. Yeah. And that was my high school. That was my soccer club. That was my college. And yes, there are hard resource decisions. There were men's teams that were canceled because of this law, and that creates backlash, and someone has to bear that backlash. So I think that's one element of it. And I would love to see that enshrined in clubs, in leagues, in federations, in governance.
Yeah, for sure.
Because how do you, against what law or rule will you hold someone accountable when they get, you know, $10,000 and they spend $9,900 of it on the men's side, and there's, you know, $100, some, you know, the women's team gets a new ball.
Which is happening now, right? When you look at the distribution of revenue across competitions, right? Cup competition, prize fund money. It's I have to tell you, it's something that blew my mind when I first came across it. And maybe I'm naive, but in my head, it was automatic that they got money. Because I was like, the sponsors charge the same. I've been on the side, you know, sponsoring and working in businesses that sponsor these events. They don't give us a discount for the fact that they're not going to pay the women the same. So I'm like, why aren't you paying the women the same? You know, it's all these kind of things that we need to unpick because they're unhealthy. And I think the word you used yesterday earlier was so perfect. They're an unhealthy system design, right? That we've just inherited from the men's game, and it's just piled on.
Well, and Beck Smith, I listened to your interview with her. It was great. She mentioned, you know, investment levels. If you want to invest, you can't give that $100 to the women and then say, well, we invested in it and it didn't work out. There's no market here. You know, you need to, I think she used invest properly. So I'm going to take that a step further and say, it's not just the women's game. That is the sport for youth development sector. If we actually believe that sport, which I do, can be a change agent for this world, can be a leader in all, any number of social issues, addressing homelessness, addressing HIV/AIDS, addressing social inclusion for refugees and immigrants, even just raising awareness of what that means and the experience of a person who's been displaced, which is 1 in every 100 people on earth.
1 in 100 people.
Yes. It's one, you know, over 1% of humanity is displaced, and we don't understand what to do about that. And I think if you believe that sport can be that influence, can be the change agent, well, then we need to stop investing $999,000 in the tiniest sliver of sport, and then throwing, you know, used equipment at the sport for social change movement and saying, great, you know, improve our outcomes, improve education, address homelessness. You can't address the problem with minor investments when 99% plus of the investment is at best reinforcing the status quo, at worst creating the problem. That is the inherent, I think, power dynamic and reinforcement that we're seeing. You know, you asked me about the groundswell. The investment isn't there. If you truly want to create a movement of change that advances gender equality from fields in Nicaragua where we work, all the way to, you know, Wembley Stadium, then you need to invest properly in those change agents, in the change you want to see. And so I think those can be one and the same, the women's game and the football for social change effort could be embedded together so as we mobilize investment, actually it's supporting the communities where there is a women's team, there's also a community movement. And who better to, you know, design for that? It hasn't been designed. I'm sure there's examples, but one of those examples is actually Oakland Roots, a new club in our backyard where one of our programs is in Oakland, they're trying to design from and with the community embedded and enshrined in their founding documents.
Yeah.
That's the change we want to see. And so I think if that was one, if I had to boil that to one thing, I don't know if that counts as one thing, but it's that.
That proper investment is a proper investment and that building with the community, right? Not yes. just shooting in, and, but actually.
And enshrining it into your reason for existence. So if you have a founding document, a bylaws, whatever it is, it needs to be in there. So it's not that, oh, COVID hit, so now we have to cancel this part because it's not profitable. It's like, no, this is a part of who we are. And if we're not doing this, then we are not doing, like we are not.
It's so true. It has to be treated like the organization's purpose, right?
Yeah.
It has to be part of the organization's purposeful design, its mission statements, its vision, its operations, yes. everything. You know, I always say to people, a really good example of a business that set itself up in the ways that you're talking about is Patagonia, right? Mm. Patagonia set up with a very clear mission. They were going to set up a business that was going to help stop the awful impact of fashion and sports apparel in particular on climate change. And they've never wavered from that, no matter what disasters come along, et cetera, because as you very articulately put it, for them, it was their reason for being. It was nothing else. And so then everything else from there made sense, because then again, they went with that very people-centric approach that you talked about so well. That is the DNA of Soccer Without Borders. Mm-hmm. You definitely feel it. And in how you talk, and also, you know, your team that I met. I think it's trying to get that to become a more natural way for people to think and act. I think that's the bit that I've certainly met challenges with when I've been trying to get people to have a buy-in into investing in grassroots sport. But as you say, it's about them going back to actually interrogate it to say, do you actually see it as this vital tool that you always say it does, you know, and all these adverts, all these things that we make, all these feel-good films, because that's where it is at the moment, right?
Right.
We're using it as cotton candy is the best way I can put it. And that's such a disservice and a disrespect to its powerful change. And I now want to kind of take some time to talk to you about the project that you did in Nicaragua, because I really love the story. How you got involved and the fact that you're still there today, because I think this shows you the value of the sort of investment we're talking about, right? Where you go somewhere, you identify that there is an issue and you really, really hanker your organization down. You root its purpose into tackling that. So I'd love you to tell us a little bit about how you got involved in Nicaragua, because I think it also probably serves, maybe I'm speaking for you, but as one of those vital lessons that's kind of defined you and how you approach your work.
Yeah, it's definitely on my personal journey. It's one of those, you know, notches that you label when you have one of those timelines, but also for Soccer Without Borders, it's an anchor program that has been transformative within the community where we work. So we started the program in Nicaragua in 2008, focused on girls. At the time, there was, you know, leagues up and down the bracket for boys and men. And, you know, as a country, Nicaragua is the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. So I don't want to pretend that even the men's side was well-resourced. There were no aspects of football were well resourced, but the resources that existed were going to boys and men.
Yeah.
And so we started with an invitation from a community member who kind of heard about what we were doing and said, you know, I think my community would really welcome this. And that's mm-hmm. really important for us. It's not, you know, we see a need. I see a need. It's that a community identifies a need and we can add, you know, we can help make it happen. We can, you know, what's the vision that we want to create together? Well, we want to create a more gender equal opportunity for sport. And we want girls to be able to succeed on the field and off. So everything we are seeing in soccer, in sport, in terms of lack of access for girls, lack of opportunity to advance, that's also the case in education. That's also the case in careers. This is a reality that girls live in, where 30% of them are pregnant by the age of 18. They, mm. they, you, you, watch girls bear the disproportionate burden of taking care of younger siblings. They're less likely to go to secondary school. So the sort of what you see on the field reflecting other barriers and challenges for girls off the field is very true there. And when you are able to create something that is different on the field, and provide other, you know, educational supports, tutoring, school scholarships, all these other opportunities, you can create pathways from the field to opportunities off. And so that's what we've done there. We've been working for 12 years. And that program really taught me about the intersection between programming and cultural norms, which we talked about at the beginning. So great program design. Absolutely. Yeah. The girls, we recruit, we go to schools, we run gym classes, we recruit girls to come to the program. They're able to work with a caring, trained mentor coach who coaches them on the field, off the field. They have access to school scholarships, which provide school uniforms, tangible financial resources that they can access to make sure they stay in school, that they have a community of peers to help them navigate adolescence, you know, and a strong team culture that supports them to make healthy choices and avoid risky behaviors. So all of that intentionality is there. I don't want to pretend that it's just, you know, only about culture or only about relationships. So strong program design plus recognizing that this is a cultural context that's defined by, I mean, there's a word, machismo is a word in the Spanish language because of this culture of men first and a lack of accountability. More than 70% of the girls in our program have their parent at home is a single mom. There's very little accountability for men to financially or emotionally care for their kids. And so that burden falls on women. And so the program has this intentional design. And then it also said, if we want to create a pathways for these girls, you know, do we create a bubble that then sends them off into a community that is like, oh, that's great, you graduated from high school, but we don't believe women should be in these other spaces. You also have to address the cultural, you know, what are the norms around this that the girls are experiencing. And so that has to come from change makers within the community who know the community best. And so that program has been led from day one. We had a team of Nicaraguan coaches, you know, working in tandem with myself and others from Soccer Without Borders based in the US. And it was a real authentic collaboration of ideas and resources. And how do we create this change within this community that these community leaders want? You know, they want to see girls with equal opportunities. We have co-directors, male and female co-directors there. Our male co-director, he has a daughter. His daughter's in the program. He wants his daughter to have.
I really love that.
Same opportunities as a son would have. So I think that is a kind of, those two things have to go hand in hand. And I'll just tell one story to sort of like bring it concretely. I think I've told you this story, Lucelli. Maybe you were fishing for it.
This is what I wanted to, explain and talk about the work you did in Nicaragua, because this story really, really touched me when you told me about it. And I think it's a very important one to tell people, particularly people who are, you know, hesitant or feel apprehensive about going into these spaces to make these changes. And I think it'll be great if you could share it, please.
Yeah, the story I was telling is about, you know, we had been working to set up this program. It's about what was my aha moment to say there needs to be this intersection of the community embracing this program and the change we want to see and great program design. So when I was there, the first time I was there in 2008, I was there with a friend of mine, Ann Cook, who played for the Washington Freedom with Mia Hamm, and you know, they won the WSA championship. She was really great player and left-footed, which makes her just like that much more tricky, I think.
I was going to say, yeah, because much harder to read left-footed players, right?
Exactly. So there's something about that. She and I were walking home with one of our local coaches named Chepe in the evening. It was dark, and like so many places in the world, we come upon a 3-versus-3 pickup soccer game under a streetlight with 6 men playing 3-versus-3. So, you know, there's 3 of us. It's teams of 3. We ask if we can challenge the winners. You know, whoever wins the next game, scores the next goal, can we play in? And they just laughed at us. It's 2 women and, you know, one of our coaches who was male, but and a local player. So he knew these guys, and they're like, no, we'll play in. And they laughed, said, sure, whatever you want, Chepe. So we play in, and, you know, every time I tell the story, I think the number of wins gets bigger. But we won something like 6 or 8 games in a row. And these guys that we're playing against, they just go through, it was like stages of grief or something. It was like, you know, they're laughing at us, and then they're angry, and then they're mad at each other. And then by the end, there was just acceptance. It was just like, if you
bet.
You're just good players. And if you can play, you can play. And, you know, they had genuinely never seen this, because for all of these structural reasons, there weren't women in their 100,000 person city that could play like this.
Yeah.
And so how do you sort of envision what you can't see?
Yeah.
And this was pre Facebook and,
to be able to go on and watch, right? It wasn't easy for them to see me to understand the high level of player they had in front of them, right?
And so even when people watch, sometimes they're like, oh, I'm better than her. And it's like, no, you're not.
Times I've heard those stupid comments and I just roll my eyes really as loud as possible. I'm like, no, you're not, because you're here.
Yeah.
You're sat here. You are not a professional player, so stop it.
Well, and that's, you know, I have to be honest, this still happens, even in this space, sport for development space. I was at a conference, I don't know, 2 years ago, and, you know, I was speaking on a panel, and just before the panel, there's all these soccer balls around. And this guy who's probably 22 or something, you know, passes me a ball, and I trap it, and I pass it back to him cleanly. Yeah. And he's like, oh, you have good technique. I'm like,
oh.
And it just, you know, the assumption that I wouldn't be able to cleanly pass a ball 10 yards when, like, I was drafted in the first round, but like, where did you play? I don't wear my soccer accolades on my sleeve. I don't do that. I haven't done that here.
Yeah.
But that just really eats at me. When it's like every single assumption is I'm starting from a baseline that I can't play, and I can't even do a basic skill well.
Yes.
And so I try to channel that into the opportunity to exceed expectations every time and just try to convert people along the way and just say, you know, the bar is pretty low for what you expect. And so in the process of exceeding your very low expectations, well, now I've got your attention. And now what am I going to do with that attention? How do I channel that into, preventing that same assumption from perpetuating?
No, I think that's such an important point. And I think I really love that phrasing. How do you channel that opportunity, right? That low bar, because you've set the bar really high. Let's be clear for everybody. Paco with our borders and Mary have set the bar really high through both your professional accolade as you were a bloody good player. I think let's be clear. There's no doubt about that. I don't want anybody arguing with that. That's a shout out to every man who plays in the park and thinks they could be better. You're not, I'm telling you. I would donate all my guest fines and prove it on that. That's how confident I am. Mary would win all the money.
Now you have me scared about these fines. I feel like they're starting to add up here.
Not at all. So now
I have a nonprofit you could donate those fines to, Lucelli.
That's true. That would be my Christmas giving. Good shout. Now you've got me to commit in public. Damn. I'm kidding. But no, I want to now spend some time to just to talk about how you have the learnings you've got through being able to find those opportunities where you got naysayers to turn that around. And I want to sort of be deliberate and get learnings from you, because I know there'll be so many people listening who'll be so inspired by the work you've done personally and professionally. And I want to almost kind of give them this as kind of a handy guide for them to be able to navigate through some of the challenges and some of the wins that you've had, you know, and how they can learn from those. Because I think it's so important when we're in this space where we're needing to really accelerate that mid-swell that we were talking about earlier. Yeah. Wow, I'd love to spend some time to just figure that out.
Yeah, let's figure it out.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We got to do this together then.
Well, you're going to. I'm just planning to take notes and learn. Yeah. Learning hour. I get a lot from these podcasts. You have no idea. I wish I'd done this when I was at university. I was sleeping. So I want to now talk about some career defining moments or projects and to understand why you see them that way and what learnings you took from them. So yeah. They can be in any particular order, and I'm going to allow you three. So the philosopher and you should be singing with joy. talk about that. But if there's not three, if it's just kind of an amalgamation of a particular intention you've had, because I know you're incredibly strategic and long-term in your planning, because I think that also will help other people to focus how they can use in a similar way?
I think my first lesson, so to speak, is ideas aren't enough to change the world. You need to build something. Yeah. And in order to build something, you need to learn how to build something. And so when we started with Soccer Without Borders, you know, Ben and I, the founder, we had other jobs. We, you know, it was an all-volunteer effort. And then it started to get this momentum. And suddenly to have employees, to be able to accept investments, you know, you need to build a business and you need to understand how to do that. You need to take care of your financials. And so I meet and talk to a lot of people who want to get involved. They want to do something. And it's like, this is also very hard, boring work sometimes. I think some people think that I'm on the soccer field all the time and I
doing all the glamorous
things. Yeah, I'm playing with these amazing kids and changing lives day after day. I'm like, I write things. I'm in Excel the majority of my day. You know, we're running a business that is actually highly scrutinized, and in the US at least, nonprofits are subject to more regulations than the average for-profit business. So we're audited every single year. Like you really need to have your house in order. So this is not
an easy gig.
It's not an easy gig, and it's and the skills that you need to operate on lean resources, you know, the startup period maybe feels longer because we still don't have a comms and marketing person. I edit our website. So, you know, we're established, we're over $2 million entity, and there's still gaps. We have one person departments, and because we put all of our resources to programming, and that's also the way that philanthropy is structured, that you have to be program forward. So all the operational side of things, you have to get good at, you have to be willing to do them. And it's not as glamorous, I guess, as the mission says. Yeah. So I just want to name that first because for me, it didn't feel like work to learn that. You know, I remember going to, bookstores. I guess that's like aging me out of a thing. Now I went to a Barnes & Noble bookstore and I pulled off all these books on nonprofit management. It's like how to set up a board, how to learn QuickBooks online. Like those are all the things that I, took the time to do. And it didn't feel like work to me because I so desperately wanted this entity to thrive so that we could do the work that was important out on the field. So I think that's lesson number one.
Yeah.
Is, take care of the business of it, because you also want your business to reflect the mission. We can't promote equity and inclusion and if we are treating our employees like they don't matter. You know, we need to create an environment that supports them as well. We need the way we do business to reflect the mission and the change we're trying to make. So that's hard to do. And it's hard to do unlimited resources. Yeah. So I think that's one big lesson.
Yeah.
I think taking with that thread of authentically being what you are advocating for. Mm-hmm. The founder of Soccer Without Borders is Ben Gucciardi. He's the one that signed the paperwork. He had the original idea. I actually didn't come into the organization until 1 year later when mm-hmm. it was very small. It was kind of under $20,000, all volunteer, very sort of amorphous vision for what it could be. And for a while, my title was just executive director. Mm-hmm. I don't think many people know that or remember that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't actually until later that Ben went to the board and advocated that I be named co-founder, because Soccer Without Borders, as it became, mm-hmm. we founded that together. We brought this into existence together, and what it is today was not what it was.
Sure.
And I think that's really important for people to know when we talk about women's work being undervalued and underpaid and underrecognized.
Yeah.
That applies to titles as well. I meet so many women who are sort of like second in command at an entity, and they are not named equal as the man who signed the papers to create the entity. And I think that was a really defining moment for me and for Soccer Without Borders to have. You know, Ben is one of my favorite human beings on earth. I think there are many men that could emulate that example of saying it's not just something I didn't demand it. You've met me. I'm not going to the board and doing that. I probably should learn that skill. But I said yes to that. And he said, this is something that you will see that people will treat you differently if you are a co-founder. Because that is something that the world is really interested in and values. I'm not sure I'd be on this podcast if I wasn't a co-founder.
Well, I can 100% guarantee you that you would be on this podcast because I think it you would be on the podcast for the very reason that I would probably ask and I would call Ben out as to why you weren't, because I'm not afraid to do that.
So. I appreciate that. And this is what we need to do, right? Is identify these things where they lie and say, okay, if the world values, you know, we have this entrepreneur, we are enamored with entrepreneurs, people who created things, but the work of creating is not signing the paperwork. The work of creating is in the building and in the failing and in the resilience to not knowing what you're doing and having every day feel like, is this the day that Soccer Without Borders is going to crumble and cease to exist? And overcoming that. And that takes thousands of moments of resilience and building and going back to the drawing board. And we did that together. And for him to name and name that needed to be equally recognized publicly, I think is a really important moment and lesson. And I hope that lesson goes to people who both have that position of power and are maybe holding on to it too tightly. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not doing the right thing, right? He did the morally just and correct thing there, which was to recognize the phenomenal input you had given to the business and also to him, right?
Right.
Because what he was saying in that moment was actually very much Soccer Without Borders' mission around achieving that gender parity. He recognized that he had an equal in you in the business building it to something that it never was before you entered it a year before. And it was so important for him to do that. And I think sometimes we don't labor enough, in my opinion, the pivotal role that men can play actually in advocating for women's parity and that recognition. Because by them taking a stand like that, it's so meaningful. The signaling of intent of what he did there is so powerful, because it's saying, I see Mary, you should all see Mary. She's a phenomenal contributor to this. In fact, she is a co-founder, and nothing more, nothing less. And you should all respect that and pay that forward in every way possible. I think that's something that the sports industry, I would say to all males running businesses and sports and just around the world, not even just sports, because unfortunately we're outnumbered everywhere, it seems, to reflect on that and say, how can you use your advantaged position as a male in power to be able to hold up a ladder for a deserving woman to get up there to then encourage a pipeline of other women leadership?
And you see that play out in our organization where we, you know, 51% of our coaches are female and over 57% of our leadership, our program leadership are female, and our board has parity and equity. You know, every level of the organization is working towards this, and we are not perfect. You know, we are also working to get girls in the game from cultures that haven't historically played the game. And, you know, so we're not at 50% in girls' participation. We were at 41% this year. But that's something we're striving for. And up and down the organization and across, people know that we value this parity. And I think when you can see it in leadership and in moments like that, then you know that it's not just words. It is truly the power dynamic and the, you know, and what we value, and that is playing out. And so I think that's a hugely important moment, and one that we also have to be willing to show when we're failing. And yeah. I think, you know, in terms of our racial and cultural mobility within the organization and reflection and leadership, you know, we were founded by Ben, who is a white male from the Bay Area in California. And, you know, I was his second, the person in the organization. And, you know, I come from a similar background on the East Coast, and, you know, the East and West of the United States does not equal diversity. So we are, you know, very thoughtful and intentional about that. And I'll be the first to admit that we're working hard to create pathways for our former participants to advance into leadership roles. You know, this is a huge priority of ours. And I think we have to also be willing to admit when we are reflecting power dynamics that we don't want to be reflecting. And what are you doing about it to change it?
I think it's making your accountability visible, right? Because then that's when you people can see that the intention is there to change it. Because I think one of the things that has struck me in this period in time when I've been speaking to many businesses and many sort of different organizations about what are they actually doing, you know, to be actively anti-racist, to be more inclusive, to open up the organizations, there's a lot of, oh, you know, we didn't know what to do, et cetera. And I say to them, you know, even just opening up for a conversation and saying, gosh, this is a blind spot for us. We're struggling with it. We're not struggling with it because we want to keep people out intentionally. It's happened indirectly, but we are recognizing that. And what are the active ways in which we're going to do it? And the example I've been giving to a lot of people who found themselves in that position has been here in the UK. There's the head of the UK athletics. Her name is Joanna Kutz. And straight, you know, not too long, sadly, after the murder of George Floyd, the debate started happening here in the UK about how does systemic racism play out, because there's been a huge deliberate silence about that in British society. And she wrote an open letter, which I really admired, where she was reflecting on the ways in which, although UK athletics, of course, on the track, mostly gets its medals from non-white athletes, is not governed in any shape or form that reflects those athletes. And she was writing an open letter inviting people from non-white backgrounds to come and apply for jobs, to come and challenge them to write about their experiences interacting with organizations. And I really admired her bravery in doing that at such a moment where there was such a lot of raw emotion and people. But I love that visibility of accountability that you just talked to. That's what she did there. And I think that's an authentic form of leadership that people can get behind.
And I think it's urgent. And it is, it has to be holistic, and it has to be genuine. That I've been thinking a lot about our sector and what our sector values. Like, why is it that two people who, you know, played soccer at university and come from fairly privileged backgrounds, you know, could start up a nonprofit with $0 and, you know, sustain it for 4 years as volunteers. And then, my first year, I quit my regular job. You know, I didn't make almost any money that year. And how was that I could just do that? Because what a privilege to get to volunteer, to get to be able to do that. And I think that at least in the United States, the system of philanthropy is designed for privilege. It's like what privileged people do to...
We add more to it somehow. Can we help them to be even more privileged and
comfortable? Yeah. And so if that is by definition the structure of the sector, how do you break free from that and say, no, our sector is not for profit. Our sector is not this. It's about building a better world. And that means it has to come. It needs to be inclusive of the voices of the world that we want to see. And so how do we build that when the skills that this sector rewards are people with networks that are connected to people with means and wealth? 70% of philanthropic dollars in the United States come from individuals. How are you connected to those individuals? And who can vouch for you? How do you get into a room with somebody?
Yeah, it becomes that referral system, right?
Yeah.
So that money is only being redistributed against the same pool of people who have it, right? So the have-nots are not actually getting that moment of access, right? And it's to say, how do you change that? And I think that's what I really love about the work you do, that although you and Ben have benefited from the system, I think you're being quite harsh on yourself here. What you've done is made sure you reinvested that back to people who didn't have the advantage of the access you did.
And we believe in generational change. And I think to take it back to that Nicaragua example, you know, that game that I played on that field was in 2008. And you fast forward 12 years and girls who were 8 years old that day that had just come into our program, they're now 20. And they work for us and they're going to college and there are coaches in addition to colleges helping them play for college. And that's a generational change where now an 8-year-old is not seeing me as her coach. She's seeing Ashley and Natalia and Milady and all of these women who started as her, just as her. And 12 years later, they are the ones coaching. And so I think maybe that brings me to my third piece of advice, which is play the long game, because the kind of change we're talking about takes a generation. It takes 5, 6, 7, 12 years. And I think there is there's these moments where I see good people leave this work because they got into it when things were, easier. When I did, I was 26, I was single. I had, few responsibilities. I could travel. I just had to worry about me. And lucky me that I was only worried about me. I wasn't needing to make money to support my family, my parents, my siblings. That was not my situation. So I was able to just focus on me and devote my time to this organization. But as people get older and they have a family or they have people that rely on them, they leave this work because they viewed it as like something that would be fun to do for a couple years.
And not to take up all their time and their energy and eat.
Yeah. And it takes time.
Inverted commas, right? Yeah.
And I would say that's, if I could change one thing about the philanthropic structure that I mentioned that perpetuates rather than make space for change, it's that time frame. Grants, they're 1-year cycles. Partnerships. It's like, well, let's do this thing for 3 months. It's like change doesn't happen in 3 months.
No way. That's just when people start to learn the new way.
Yes.
Right? That's when people just start to get used to the idea that you've introduced a new concept.
Right.
3-month stage.
Maybe you've planted a seed and you've been able to identify who wants to walk with you, but you better get some good shoes because you're going to be walking for like a decade. If you really want to see change, who are the 8-year-olds in your program today? Who are the 8-year-olds in your community today? Because they are the change that you want to invest in 10 years from now, 20 years from now. And I wish we could make that change as a as a society to stop thinking in these very short term, how can I look good now? And I want to make a difference now. I even frame it positively, not how do I look good, how do I make a difference now that I can see and feel and touch. It's like the real lasting change takes time. Can we extend the time frame on these grants multi-year? Can we extend, you know, if you are an individual with means and you want to make a difference, give perpetually, like give and trust, build the trust first. If change happens at the pace of trust, build the trust first, but then invest over the long term and give space for failures, give space for learning, because that's the only way that, you know, 10 years from now, this is going to be different. So I'm hoping things like climate crisis show us there is no quick fix solution to this. This is a way that we need to change as a generation, the way we do things. And I think, you know, there are so many other crises within humanity that need the same approach: displacement, structural injustice and racism. These are not quick fixes. These are generational changes that need to happen. And our system of social change is not designed for that. It's designed for short bursts of investment that, you know, spark interest. And some of them are very good. And it's like, okay, you just lit a spark. You did not light a fire. So you need to...
It needs to think much more strategically about that.
And long-term. Yes.
I think it's also about legacy, right? Yeah. I think sometimes the other way we don't ask sometimes the questions when it comes to these investment opportunities, organizations or individuals who have that, is to say, actually, what would I like my legacy to be in getting involved with that? And I think if the question was framed more about a legacy and setting society to start putting more value in legacy and what comes after you're gone, right?
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be the framing in order for it to be the real good intent that goes into those investment opportunities, because I do get quite frustrated myself at, because they has been kind of, let's say, a fashionization of these short-term things that needs to stop. And so whilst we are on the subject of legacy, I can't help but ask you, what would you like your legacy to be, Mary? Because you've talked so wonderfully and eloquently and in a way that has got me really fired up and inspired. Do more with my position, but what would you like, you know, if you were looking back at this in 20 years time, that long-term view that we're talking about, what would you like to be happy to have someone say if you overheard them?
One manifestation of legacy I would love to see a participant of Soccer Without Borders leading Soccer Without Borders in that time, and leading the, you know, and an organization that is supporting people with the same people-centric, you know, community-driven values that we started with. I think that would be...
It's an ideology that you've got there, and it's such a powerful one.
A manifestation of it. But I think when I think bigger than that, you know, I was reflecting on coming into this conversation, you know, I suspected you would ask me that, Lucelli. So I was just thinking about where I kind of came from, and I was raised hyper competitive. You know, I talked about my brother and my dad. My brother and I were competitive at everything. Like we would get out of the minivan and race to the front door. I had a paper route for 5 years. I delivered newspapers and so did my brother, and their paper routes were right next to each other. So we would race to like get home, get them done first. And we would compete on like who got bigger tips, and like everything was a competition. And that was so pervasive. The first 22 years of my life was like living for a resume. How can I collect awards? If I got less than 100 on a test in school, I was miserable for the day. Like I was hyper competitive about school and soccer and really anything. And so I think about that person that I was growing up, and, you know, there's a lot of that that's still embedded in me. And, you know, I think it, it helps me get up every morning and motivate when I don't really have someone looking over my shoulder. But there's also an element of that that I just totally am disconnected from, in saying, how was it that I was raised to really live for my resume and not my legacy? And you know, morbidly, your eulogy, like how do you live for that instead of your resume? And like, does it really matter to be, you know, what trophies you collect? I literally just threw out all of my trophies. That, you know, what does it matter if what those trophies don't represent is friendships and love and ambition and hard work? Like, what do those actually mean to you? And so for me, I think the best legacy that I could leave is people that who genuinely felt like, you know, we did something together that was meaningful, that that made their life happier and fuller and better. And I think that is the philosopher in me. That's like, what is the greatest good? What is the good that we seek in life? And to me, that's love and friendship and empathy and trying to be, you know, a person that lifts others up. And I think that the only way to measure that would be in true friendships and people that believe not in me, but in the, you know, in carrying that work forward. So that's why I say I think it would manifest as somebody who sort of like came through Soccer Without Borders and is leading it. I think that would be like the tangible piece of it. But I would just love to, for people to, I would love for that to be my legacy, just for people to seek and act on the change they want to see and, you know, get up every day and try to do that.
Yeah, no, I think it's fair to say that you are already there, Mary. Everybody, no, I mean this seriously. When I talk to everybody about you and the work that you do, it's so synonymous. You know how sometimes you speak to founders of a place and their personality and what they do are two separate things, but with you, it's not. They're so intertwined and so fueled in, and I've been incredibly inspired by watching you from afar, and it's been a real privilege for me, if I'm honest, to get to know you a little bit more, especially during this difficult time, getting to have this interview with you, because you're an incredible change catalyst. I think incredibly brave, and that level of authentic leadership that you show will definitely be your legacy and something we can all really learn from at this time in the world. So thank you.
I appreciate you for, you know, to hear that this also came about at a time of hardship in your life. And when you channel that into how do I lift up others? How do I use the skills I have to create something that elevates the voices of women who are, you know, trying to build this change? I just really respect that so much and appreciate you so much. I appreciate you including me.
It's been awesome. So thank you. I think we can both equally say it's been a great experience. So thank you so much to everybody for listening in. I've been with the absolutely inspirational Mary McRae Connor, and this has been In Her Corner.